This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorick. The town of Winthrop and our greater Boston community is mourning the deaths of two people who served this country and whose lives were ended in a horrific act of violence this weekend. 60-year-old Ramona Cooper was an Air Force staff sergeant. Her son says she was caring and selfless, ready to help anybody in need. 68-year-old David Green was a retired state trooper, described as a true gentleman by his fellow troopers, and who had apparently just dropped off a batch of fresh cherries to a neighbor before being gunned down in the street. There'll be a candlelight vigil in Winthrop on Thursday to honor both of them. In the meantime, prosecutors are now investigating the deaths as a hate crime. Police say 28-year-old Nathan Allen hijacked a truck before crashing it into a home on Shirley Street. Allen then got out of the car, shooting and killing Cooper and Green before he was shot by police. Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins says, quote, "The only two people that he opened fire on were two visible people of color."
There are some troubling white supremacist rhetoric that was found in the hard police work that they did. In this individual, Nathan Allen's own handwriting, writing anti-Semitic and racist statements against black individuals.
For the latest on the investigation, we're joined by Mike Bellow, deputy city editor for the Boston Globe. Mike, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon, Chris.
So, Mike, you just heard that cut from DA Rollins. Can you tell us more about exactly what police have found in Allen's home?
Well, I think, you know, they're really focusing on Nathan Allen's background. What, if any, ties does he have to any of these white supremacist groups? How did, you know, these writings emerge? We know the police went to his apartment on Saturday. We talked to a woman who lived in the building where Nathan Allen lives, said he always got packages all the time, was constantly sitting outside writing. Was not sure what. We know he was a physical therapist, had been educated and gotten a degree, I think at UMass Dartmouth, and had done some kind of internship for physical therapy, recently married last year. But what his ties to these groups are, I think, is probably a chief focus of the investigation, along with, you know, any his background in terms of mental health and any other issues that may be emerging there. We attempted to get a hold of his wife. She refused to comment. But I think they're really looking into Nathan Allen's background and obviously what precipitated this violent spree where he allegedly stole the truck, a plumbing truck, and then went on this rampage after crashing the truck in Winthrop.
Yeah, D.A. Rollins said basically there was nothing in his background that kind of provided any red flags prior to this incident, right?
Immediately they saw nothing that jumped out. He also was licensed to carry a handgun. We're trying to figure out where he got the license to carry the gun, and why did he need to carry a handgun? So those are real issues which are still emerging.
Yeah, and I read that quote from Rachel Rollins. There were other people at the scene, according to witnesses, that he appeared to choose not to target. Correct.
Right. We've gotten some incredible witnesses. We got this guy, Bill Leach, a neighbor of retired state trooper David Green, who talked about how he and Green were standing outside in the yard when they heard the crash. And Green, you know, they looked out, they checked what happened. And then Leach says that Green grabbed him, turned him around and yanked him into an alleyway. And then he looked up and the shooter was standing right beside them. Leach said he looked at the shooter, shut his eyes, and thought he was going to get shot, didn't get shot. But then, you know, Mr. Green got shot. Leach heard an officer yell at Allen to drop his weapon, then saw the officer shoot him. There was another witness, Kim Carrillo, amazing stuff, saying that she was getting dressed to get a slushie down the street in Shirley Street in Winthrop when she heard the crash into that building, poked her head outside, and then ran down the street when she saw Ramona Cooper getting shot on the next block and tried to render aid to the woman. Just a horrific, horrific scene.
Wow.
So these wrenching accounts are among some of the residents telling us what happened on that fateful Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, and I think one of the big questions, obviously, we're still trying to get to is why. D.A. Rollins has theorized and talked about the fact that Allen may have been driving towards an area of town that has multiple Jewish temples. Do we know anything more about that, and is there any reason to believe that's where he was heading when he crashed?
I have not heard anything about that. No idea where he was heading or what he was doing or even why he stole a plumbing truck. We're trying to figure that out, but nothing new on why. And he also, he allegedly, I think he may have had two weapons. A lot of unanswered questions here, but there's nothing new on a motive at this point. And I think, I know the DA is having a press conference at 4 o'clock this afternoon, where I'm sure more information. They did release a new picture of the suspect that they have, I'm sure there'll be more information revealed on him or what the probe into his background is focusing on.
I want to ask you, I mentioned that they're investigating this as a hate crime. As someone who's reported on law enforcement for a long time, you know, the alleged perpetrator we're talking about here is dead. Is there a significance here in investigating these killings as a hate crime as opposed to kind of a standard murder investigation?
Well, I think investigators really would want to find out, you know, obviously why he did this. Is he tied to any group, or was it just a, you know, a psychic break that contributed to this? Was he somehow radicalized with white supremacist or anti-Semitic views? The DA stressed yesterday that he acted alone. No one else appears to be involved. But the question is, what caused Mr. Allen to engage in this violence spree, this behavior? And I think it's imperative, even though he is gone, to figure out what happened. How did he get the weapons? Like I told you, this neighbor said he was getting packages all the time. What were in the packages? I know there was a search of his apartment the other night, and they evacuated the area. Not sure what they found, but I'm sure that investigators are combing what they have recovered and trying to figure out what is linked to this violent spree in Mr. Allen.
Yeah, just getting a little more on the 4 o'clock press conference that DA Rachel Rollins is going to hold. Apparently, there is going to be no investigatory updates. It's really focused on the availability of trauma services and community resources. Mike, before I let you go, I want to end here by having you take some time to remember the victims. As I said, these are two people who serve their community and their country. WBUR's Anthony Brooks actually spoke to Ray Green, who's David Green's older brother, earlier today, and here's what he had to say.
Didn't have to be like a car wreck or some type of crime. If someone needed help, flat tire on the side of the road, or a person came by today, told me that they had a sick dog, he said, hey, put him in the back seat, we'll take him to the vet. That's the type of person he was all the time, all throughout his life.
Tell us a little more about what you're hearing from family, friends, community members about the two victims.
I think it's just amazing. Both of them were well liked by neighbors. Would really help out when needed. Green was always talking, always out in the community. Ramona Cooper, also neighbors said she was very kind. Her son issued a statement saying that he was heartbroken. But these were two fine people, people who were well known in their neighborhood, people who'd made a difference, and. It's certainly the neighborhood and the town of Winthrop is in mourning now for two people who mattered and are no longer with us.
Well, we're going to keep our eye on this story, and WBUR will have more as details continue to emerge. That's Mike Bello, Deputy City Editor for the Boston Globe. Mike, thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you, sir.
Before the break, we talked about the latest on the tragic killing of two people in Winthrop over the weekend. Listening in on that conversation was Michael Curry, head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Michael, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, I feel like every few weeks we're bombarded with just awful news from across the country, people who are targeted and killed based on race or ethnicity. We mentioned these killings in Winthrop are being investigated as hate crimes. I'm just wondering kind of how you reacted, how this news was resonating you over the weekend.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that those of us credit to the Anti-Defamation League and their leadership in tracking hate crimes, credit to those activists who are trying to respond to these hate crimes with pushing policy, with laws that will prevent some of these things from happening. They pay attention. While the rest of us, many other people across this country, sort of tune out, they become episodic, when the reality is these things are on the rise. 267 plots or attacks since 2015, 91 or so fatalities. There are people who are paying attention while many of us get to go to bed at night and not worry about it. So I immediately flash back to some other cases, the Charleston massacre in 2015. I thought about those members of the synagogue in December 2019 who in a home of a rabbi was attacked. I immediately thought about Brockton, Massachusetts, and people may have forgotten here at home, the Brockton murders where Keith Luke killed two Cape Verdeans, similar case, hate crimes. So we have a problem both here and across the country, and we have to stop turning off our televisions and stop thinking that this is isolated. You can have a PhD, you can be a family man or woman and still harbor hate and commit murder, and it'd be a hate crime.
Yeah, you mentioned the national connection. Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins is very much framing this as part of the larger national issue. I want to play a little bit of what she said to WBUR's Deborah Becker on Morning Edition today. It's a little bit of a longer cut, but hang in there because there's a lot here to unpack.
This individual, for all intents and purposes, appeared outward facingly, for whatever this definition is, normal, right? This was a 28-year-old, highly educated, working man married in a quiet town of Winthrop, but beneath the surface, there were many other things going on. And I think it's just really important where we find ourselves in this country. If there is fear among, you know, a large population of men in this age demographic, we don't have to kowtow to that. But I do think we need to start talking about it because this is erupting across our country in violence that's fueled by hate.
What's your response to that?
Yeah, you know, it comes on the heels of a national debate about whether we need to understand where that kind of hate comes from. And we've had that national debate based on some congressional hearings. It is real. We saw that on January 6th when folks, not all of them harboring hate, but some of them, you know, the gentleman who walked through the U.S. Capitol with the Confederate flag, the many others who had hate and anti-Semitic rhetoric and signage. This is a very difficult time in American history. And I always think of it as our what we went through in Reconstruction with the backlash to all the progress when folks start advancing constitutional amendments in that time, like the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. There was a backlash to that. There were white folks who felt like they were being disenfranchised or that it was about sharing power and having black men ascend into Congress, those 2,000 or so black men that took seats in state legislatures and sheriff's departments and in Congress. There was a backlash to that. And I think we're seeing that backlash now to the 8 years of Obama, to all of this rhetoric around racial justice. It should not be a surprise to any of us if we know history.
Yeah, a little context to that. Christopher Wray, the FBI director, said a couple of months ago that since he started in 2017, the number of arrests for racially motivated violent extremists who were categorized as white supremacists has almost tripled just in those 4 years. With all of that in mind, how do we heal as a community? How do we heal as a country? How do we move forward?
Yeah, you know, I think the healing starts with consciousness, right? Is that first we got to understand that we have a problem. It's almost like if you go to a program around substance use, right? First is acknowledging we have a problem. And I often say, and I've said it on this program and others, that we have an issue where we don't recognize that there's racial hatred. It's not just about implicit bias. It's not about somebody that just won't hire you or promote you or compensate you fairly. There is racial animus in the hearts of way too many Americans, and it plays out in the classroom. On street corners when the police engage you, in the doctor's office, and so forth. We now need to embrace that we have a racial issue with racial animus in this country and then start dismantling that. That's with education, with awareness. We need to penetrate some of these households, right? Because it's not in the class that you're going to dismantle that. It's that grandchild or that child that's going to say to that grandfather, grandmother, mother, or father, that's wrong. That's not inclusive. That's hate. And we have to start really spreading news that this can be done, but we all have to commit to it.
I want to bring in another voice on this. And so joining us on the line is Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be on.
So we've been talking about the fact that this shooting in Winthrop is being investigated as a hate crime. I want to ask you a question I kind of posed Mike Bello with the Boston Globe. This is a shooter who was killed in a confrontation with police. So what does that mean for the investigation to proceed as a hate crime investigation?
Well, it can't be prosecuted, obviously, because if the putative defendant is dead, it can't be the subject of a criminal prosecution. That doesn't mean it can't be the subject of an investigation. And to find out, an investigation that would have sort of two prongs to it. One is looking to see who helped him, if anyone, who radicalized him, if anyone, to go to the sort of genesis of the crime, and criminal charges could come out of that. I understand he had a legal gun. How did he get a legal gun? What were the circumstances of that? So criminal prosecutions could come concerning others who aided and abetted him. And then there's a reason to do an investigation so that we understand how it happened. Whether or not it produces a criminal case is really, is beside the point at this point. It's a question of how did it happen? Why? Why wasn't he on anybody's radar? How do we avoid it happening in the future? But obviously there's no prosecution here.
Yeah, and again, I should just mention we're obviously in the very early stages of the investigation, so there's a lot of details to figure out as we proceed. I do want to take a step back because all of this is happening in the wake of Derek Chauvin's sentencing last Friday. He received a sentence of 22.5 years for the murder of George Floyd. Judge Gertner, let me start with your reaction to that sentence.
Well, that's a very long sentence. I know that there was a reaction that the prosecutor wanted 30 years, and that became the measure for some people of what a fair sentence was, what the prosecutor wanted. It could well have been a measure of what would be a fair sentence, but I want people to pause for a moment, because what the prosecutor wants in cases is not necessarily the measure of a fair sentence. It's the measure of what one advocate wanted. So 22 years is in other countries is the longest sentence meted out. The measure here, the reason why this is so hard to sentence, there were guidelines that the judge had to follow, and once he concluded that there were aggravating circumstances, he was out of the guideline range, which I think was up to 10 years. So how do you, there's nothing commensurable here. How do you figure out what someone like Chauvin deserves? It's not about deterrence, right? Because, the 20 years will deter as much as 30. It's not about recidivism. This Chauvin is not going to do this again, one can imagine. It's really an expressive measure, a measure of retribution. What does the crime deserve? And we really have no way of measuring that. I just said a moment ago that the prosecutor's sense of it deserving 30 is not necessarily the measure here. Prosecutors oftentimes go high, anticipating that the judge will go lower. And there's a danger here, and this gives me pause, much as I think what he did was horrific and, beyond contempt. There's a danger here if you say, well, you treat black people badly in our courts to sentences that are disproportionate, therefore a white cop should surely get that as well. That's how we bid up sentences over the past 40 years.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Michael, I want to bring you in on this. Did you watch the proceedings Friday? How were you reflecting on the outcome, especially kind of in the wake of the news this weekend?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I channel the voices and experiences of many African-Americans across this country and many historically that have seen charges of murder of African-American men, I should say, that have been long. And they've been, in many cases, at the discretion of the judge. And I think what we see across our criminal justice system is discretion. When you get beyond the guidelines and it becomes discretion around what's fair, it is often tainted by race. It's so funny. I think about Rachel Rollins and her investigation of the previous case we're talking about. I think about Marilyn Mosby. I think about some white and black prosecutors across the country who charge crimes that many white prosecutors wouldn't charge. And we've argued for years that if you get more diversity in our criminal justice system, whether it's the judges, the juries, the police officers, the prosecutors, that the outcomes would be different and that we would get more equity in the sentencing, more equity in parole and probation and charges. So I think this falls in the same category. I was disappointed it wasn't 30. I honestly believe that the judge could have and had the aggravating circumstances to go,
as high as 30 years. But I'm conflicted, as I've said publicly, because this was a tear in that cloak of protection that we give law enforcement that means that you could take a life unjustifiably, particularly a Black life, and not suffer the consequences. We know that in many cases, I think it's 147 or so, 42 police involved shootings and charges were brought. Very few get convicted and very few get charged any considerable amount of time.
I want to play a little bit of sound here from Minnesota Judge Peter Cahill, basically right before he read the sentence. Here's a little bit of what he said.
What the sentence is not based on is emotion or sympathy. But at the same time, I want to acknowledge the deep and tremendous pain that all the families are feeling, especially the Floyd family. I'm not basing my sentence also on public opinion. I'm not basing it on any attempt to send any messages. The job of a trial court judge is to apply the law.
Judge Gertner, I want to come back to a phrase you used in your last answer. You talked about that's how we bid up sentences in this country. Could you talk a little bit about more about that? And did you face that when you were on the bench? And kind of how did that factor into your decision making as you were thinking about sentencing?
Sure. I mean, the demand to make things equal in a criminal legal system that has not been equal is very compelling. The fact that African American, mostly men, have been treated to sentences that are wildly disproportionate should matter to all of us. And I actually try to think that if Chauvin were Black and the victim were white, what would he have gotten? No question that would be, not necessarily in the judge's mind, but we should worry about. The problem, though, is that unfairness and outrageous disproportionate sentences with respect to the African American community, what that's going to mean, the equality then means constantly raising our sentences to equalize with an equally unfair sentence that African American men are getting. So I think that's something that should give us pause. So that's one principle that should give us pause. And as I said, the other principle, the notion that the prosecutor has the corners of the market on fairness here, we're picking numbers out of the air, right? Because it's not grounded in will this make a difference? It's grounded in symbolism, and we just have to pause at that symbolism. 22 and a half years is a very, very long time. I have no sympathy for the man at all. I'm simply talking about the length of the sentence.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
And I absolutely understand the judge's point in that. It's so funny. I coach a young lady who's doing a speech for the National NAACP competition. And one of the lines in her speech is, it justice or just us? So I think about the many others throughout history. I think about the Central Park Five or the Exonerated Five. I think about the many cases of young men I grew up with. And I know it's great to say, OK, now we just need to adjust the whole system so that we're meeting out fair sentences across the board, no matter what race they are. That's not how we've operated historically. That's not how it's operating today. And we can't necessarily say to the African-American family that's sitting somewhere in America right now and in Roxbury and saying, my son didn't get that sort of a reasonable sentence, or my daughter didn't get that reasonable sentence. It is the system we have. And I think for that young lady's speech, justice as it's operating now could have been a 30-year sentence. And I do believe it's a deterrence. When I think about those prosecutors over the years who said, throw the book at them, get these violent criminals, as Mike Barnicle called them, the beasts where the streets where the beasts prowl the streets, which is he called Roxbury Black men. Why is that rhetoric now not being applied to this white officer who brazenly took the life of a Black man on the street in front of millions, billions now, social media? And ultimately, there is a message, and I know the judge said that wasn't the purpose, but we've seen judges send messages for years, decades, a message that no officer who commits murder, when we've given them the heightened authority, the deference to carry a gun and a badge, will ever be accepted in this country to commit that kind of a murder.
I'm just really struck by, I've seen a lot of reaction on social media talking about the sentence and comparing. We've talked about how the outcomes of a criminal justice system are incredibly inequitable, and there's lots of data to back that up. Folks saying it's not even about a similar crime, but my cousin is in jail for 20 years for marijuana possession or something, even a lesser crime. So I guess I'm wondering, Judge Gertner, you're talking about fairness in sentencing across the board. How do you reconcile that with the reality of the way things operate in our current system?
Well, I don't. I mean, I'm torn. I don't know. I think to myself what I would have done in the situation of this judge. It's not reconcilable, but people at least have to step back and realize that to make the system equitable so that white defendants are suffering as much as black defendants are, we're just going to keep on increasing sentences. We're just going to keep on increasing sentences. That the measure can't be the unfairness in the to which African American people have been sentenced. I mean, that's the problem here, and that was the reason that from 1985 until now, sentences just kept on going up and up.
That something you thought about on the bench? I know you've talked a lot.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
How that mindset works?
No, I thought about that all the time. I thought because there's no logic to 22, 25, 30, 50, 60. There's no magic to those numbers. It's a question of what we think. You know, it's in part, as I said, it's expressive. It's sort of what makes us. One measure is how we treat African Americans. That's sort of true. That's one measure. But otherwise, these are abstractions. There is an argument here that the appropriate measure is not how badly African American men are treated. The appropriate measure here is that this was really not just murder, but it was torture. That it was not just murder. There was a Somali American police officer in Minnesota who was sentenced for shooting a white woman, mistakenly shooting a white woman. He got 20 years. And so there's an argument here that there's a difference between a spur of the moment shooting, terrible and racist as that was in the other direction, and torture. And that could be a justification for saying, well, this should be higher, and for saying that this is a unique crime. But I just want to caution that we regularly sentence on the basis of rage. And that rage has bid up sentences for the past 30 years.
I know that case you're talking about, the woman's name was Justine Diamond. I believe the sentence was about 12 and a half years.
12 and a half, okay.
Yeah.
But one could argue, and we're trying to come up with rules, with standards here. One could argue that, you know, Chauvin was much worse than that, as indeed it was. And then you want to look at who gets 30 years in Minnesota. I'm just arguing for, you know, we can't bid up sentences for a white police officer and not run the risk that we're bidding it up across the board.
Yeah. Michael, I want to give you the last word here. What is the lesson? What can we learn from this as we attempt to move forward?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to learn from it. And just to the judge's point, I think that, you know, the fairness in sentencing is a conversation it should be all of us should be engaged in from every level to make sure that the fizz are fair. But I will tell you just viscerally, as an African-American man and many of us across the country that are African-Americans, people of color, we wanted to see 30 years. And I think 30 years would have really been a statement that we were looking for our judicial system, that it isn't just us, that it is about justice. And if you're meeting out harsh sentences for African-American men, meet out harsh sentences for white men who kill African-Americans, as the judge said, and brazenly using torture while he was being recorded. I think ultimately we have a lot to do. That aspirational place that I think the judge wants to get to, that we all want to get to, we need to be zealous advocates to get to that place soon. Otherwise, you will see this divide continue to exist on how we see our judicial system.
That's Michael Curry, head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
And Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The heat is on. We're not recording a promo for TV 38. It's a little 80s pop culture local humor for you. What's not funny, New England is in the midst of its second heat wave this month, and that is striking. I mean, last time Boston saw two heat waves in June, 1941. Today and tomorrow are shaping up to be the highest temperatures of the wave, forecasted highs set to peak around the mid-90s, and it's expected to feel hotter than 100 degrees in many places. Boston Acting Mayor Kim Janey's declared a heat emergency for the city starting today, and several cities in Massachusetts are also under heat advisories. Some communities will be feeling those scorching temps more than others. Here to tell us more is Sanjay Sait, Climate Resilience Program Manager for the City of Boston. And a little bit later, we will take calls from you as well about how you are planning to stay cool over the next few days. So feel free to jump on board 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Sanjay, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here today.
So remind us first, what exactly are we talking about when we say a heat island, and why are they so concerning?
Yeah, I mean, a heat island, let's take a case of Chinatown, for instance. If you think about a day, July 20th, 2019, where we had a similar experience, the high was mid-90s and the low was low 80s, each neighborhood didn't experience that heat in the same way. So on that day, even though it was 95 degrees in Boston as a whole, at the area around the Chinatown gate, it was more like 106 degrees. And at night, it was about 90 degrees in Chinatown, even though it was about 10 degrees cooler. So that's a neighborhood that's a heat island. And when we say heat island, all we're really saying is, this is a part of the city that doesn't have as many trees or parks. It has dark roofs and buildings made with materials that store a lot of heat. And so when it gets hot, it stays hot. And that means that a heat wave impacts residents and neighborhoods differently across Boston based upon where you live.
And there's a pretty direct tie from these heat islands to other inequities in the city, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So, you know, we know when we think about the history of Boston and how we've developed as a city, not every neighborhood is receive the same level of investment in public infrastructure that can protect residents from the effects of both extreme heat and poor air quality. So the things that can protect you are things like parks and trees and shade and other amenities. And you might not see that in some communities. And so when we think about who's impacted by climate change, not everyone experiences it the same way. And a lot of it has to do with where you live and, you know, the history that we have as a city.
So what can we do about that as a city? What are the measures that we are taking and what are the measures we can take moving forward?
So today, you know, for this heat wave, Mayor Janey has declared a heat emergency, which allows the city to provide additional resources to residents to beat the heat. And you can learn more about those free resources at boston.gov/heat. We also provide residents with a 311 hotline so they can learn more about these free resources, like the cooling centers we offer all throughout the city. So there are resources and things that we're providing to residents today to make sure that they're safe. They can get access to cooling when they need it. And then a lot of our work in Climate Ready Boston is also thinking about, you know, in the decades to come. So in the past 5 years, we've had anywhere from 12 to 23 days over 90 degrees. But in a couple decades, we could see up to 40 days. And in a few more decades, up to 90 days of temperatures over 90 degrees.
So that seems hold on. Yeah, I have to stop you there because that is staggering. Are we equipped to handle that?
Are we equipped to handle that? I think that's the work of Climate Ready Boston and the work we're doing with our communities today. We currently are working with communities throughout the city to run our citywide heat resilience plan, which means how do we take action today and in the coming decades to ensure that folks are safe and can stay cool when we have these heat waves. You know, that includes everything from thinking about trees and how we can increase tree cover in our neighborhoods, how we can change the roofs of buildings that are sometimes very dark and absorb heat. How do we change those to be more reflective or to be green roofs even? So there's a lot of things that we know we can do, and we're currently planning on how we're going to do that in the city of Boston today.
We know the city of Boston has talked about the inequities kind of across the board. You've talked about heat islands being a pretty serious and risky inequity here. Is there a targeted effort from the city of Boston to deal with this and to address some of these neighborhoods that are feeling the heat even more than others?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, in our heat resilience plan, we're focusing on five neighborhoods that experience significant heat impacts in terms of they're exposed to a lot of heat, but also neighborhoods that may not have the same level of tree cover or the same access to cooling than other neighborhoods. And so when we think about what can we do as a city, a lot of that is physical, like trees and shade and whatnot. And then some of it's even operational, like how do we make sure folks have access to the resources they need when they need it? That's why we have the 311 number that you can call right now. And that's why we have our cooling centers and other supports for elderly through our Age Strong Commission. There's a lot of things we can do that are physical, a lot of things we can do in how we work together to protect each other. This is a good time to check on your neighbor. There's a lot of things the city can do, but there's also a lot of things you can do. And checking on your neighbor, your family, your friends, making sure they're safe and cool and have access to cooling is a really important step in making sure all of us can be protected.
Yeah, especially for your elderly neighbors as well.
Exactly.
So let me, is that something you talk to other cities around the state or even around the country in terms of how to best deal with the issue?
Yeah, thankfully, Boston is a part of many national and international networks where we collaborate and think about how we can deal with heat. You know, one of the things to think about is, you know, by the 2050s, Boston summers may be as hot as Washington, D.C.'s summers today. And by the end of the century, our summers may be as hot as Birmingham, Alabama. So there's a lot that we can learn from other cities that can help us anticipate some of the impacts that we're facing today.
All right. As someone who sweats as soon as we go a drop above 70 degrees, I'm really feeling the heat on this one. So I keep coming back to this idea that by the end of the decade, we're going to potentially have more than 40 days a year where temps are over 90s. I'm wondering, and I'd love to hear from folks on this, 1-800-423-8255. How do you stay cool? What's your personal secret? Sanjay. I'm looking at you. Help us out.
Sorry, what's my personal secret?
Yeah. Are you a pool guy? Are you a beach guy? What's the right move, you think?
My move is to find cooling, to take cold showers, to not be out during the hottest part of the day. It's very straightforward. I like making sure that I have a lot of water. A lot of things you need to do are pretty simple, but sometimes it's hard to remember to do them until you're feeling kind of dizzy. So it's important to make sure to, you know, take a moment, think about where you're at, how you're feeling, what can you do to get cool? That's what we all need to do, and we need to make sure our friends and family are doing the same.
So speaking of friends and family, I want to bring in another friend of the show here. Kiana Agbai is a Boston parent, entrepreneur, author of the blog and Instagram account Harlem Lovebirds. Kiana, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So first of all, I get points this segment for not saying it's a scorcher or it's wicked hot out there, right? I definitely want my props for that. Kiana, you are a parent. You've got kids. That's got to be an extra challenge keeping cool, especially when we're talking about feeling hotter than 100 degrees out there.
Oh, definitely. And it's coming off of the hills of remote learning, too, like for my son. Just a couple weeks ago, finishing up at Boston Public Schools, and he had the choice to be in person or remote, and he was remote with me at home. So he was only itching to get outside. And now here it is, his first full week of break, and it's so hot for him. So we're trying to get creative over here.
All right. So what are you doing? What are the creative solutions?
Well, he really loves the splash pads, and our community in Hyde Park has a lot of splash pad options. So it's really fun to be able to make the rounds. He actually turned 7 over the weekend, and we went to our local playground just for a little play date with some friends. And we saw a family got really creative and rigged up their own slip and slide to the splash pad. So that was a hit. They set the bar really high.
So, I'm racking my brain here because I think the old move used to be go to the movies, right? Or go to a museum, go somewhere indoors with air conditioning, and you can't do that. Talk a little bit about the tension of the pandemic. Obviously, many of us adults are now vaccinated, but the kids just don't have that capability yet. How challenging is that, Kiana?
Yeah, that's very true. So my 7-year-old and my 10-year-old, my daughter, she'll be 11 in August. In the summers, I'm used to doing a little bit of a hybrid camp mommy. So they might do a program in the community for a little bit. We love Tenacity, the local tennis program. But of course, with the heat, that's a challenge. And also, they are very aware at 7 and almost 11 years old that they're not included in the vaccination age group. So they do take their precautions, with masking and things like that, still very much so. But even on a family bike ride, like yesterday, we were on the trails here in Boston on our bikes and wearing our masks and, you know, still doing distancing best we can. But it gets hot even with the mask on. So we'll try to get out earlier in the day and work around that obstacle.
1-800-423-8255 if you want to jump on board and tell us how you stay cool. Sanjay, I'm curious how the city is thinking about the fact that we are still in a pandemic and there is a portion of the population that cannot get vaccinated yet. You talked about cooling centers and things like that. How are you balancing offering places for folks to come stay cool, but also making sure we're staying safe in the pandemic?
That's a great question. You know, we are making sure these cooling centers are available. We're taking clear precautions. Folks are wearing masks. It's safe to go to your cooling centers. If you don't feel comfortable, there are lots of places you can find cooling if you're able to go to, you know, the freezer aisle of your grocery store. That's usually too cold. You know, there's a lot of places you can get creative and find cooling. I think your point about the pandemic, though, is really, really well taken, because the pandemic has shown us a glimpse of our climate future in a way, if we don't act thoughtfully. It's affected people of color more. It's affected low and moderate income people more. And it's affected people with fewer educational opportunities more. So, you know, when we think about a transformative recovery from this pandemic, making sure that what we do today not only helps residents recover from the pandemic, but assures they're safer from other threats to their health and well-being, like climate change, that's core to the work that the city's doing.
Sanjay, as we're talking with Kiana about families and kids, is the city thinking about kids specifically in terms of offering? I know, like, the Frog Pond is open. I've seen pictures of everybody splashing around down there. What's the city thinking about for families, especially families with young kids, as we hit this heat wave?
Yeah, and for families that have been indoors, being teachers and parents at the same time, it can, you know, you want to be outside. You want to be experiencing this summer. And so, you know, the city of Boston has a range of splash pads, outdoor pools. If you go to boston.gov/cool, you can find the nearest pool to you and make sure that you can go out and get cool there. There's a lot of places you can go. In our parks that are shady, some of our largest parks are usually about 5 to 10 degrees cooler during the day. So there are ways to still get out, but make sure to do so safely and drink a lot of water.
Kiana, I'm wondering, do you take advantage of, like, the frozen treats of summer? Think the, you know, traditional ice cream truck driving through the neighborhood, or busting out the popsicles, or maybe make some homemade popsicles? Any frozen treats to help keep cool?
Oh, definitely. We love our popsicles. In fact, instead of a traditional birthday cake at his birthday party, we just brought a cooler full of popsicles for all the kids. So that was a hit. And I think, in our community in Hyde Park, they had a local truck show recently, and they had complimentary treats on the ice cream truck for everyone. So that was really nice. So we're definitely on the lookout for things like that in our community. And it's almost like a treasure hunt of sorts to see what's going on from day to day.
All right. 1-800-423-8255. If you want to offer us your tips, let's go to Scott in Cambridge. Scott, welcome. What's on your mind?
Well, you've talked a lot about outside, but what about internal? I'm not much for spicy food, but I have found that if I take a cayenne capsule, right, it has the capsaicin in it, with food, so it doesn't upset my stomach, it actually helps, you know, revs up my body and helps me to cool myself off internally.
Interesting. So you don't like the spicy food. That's why you take the capsule?
No.
Because I'll take the spicy food. Like, let's get something with some kick. Absolutely. But that's a way to kind of get that. Yeah.
Lots of the places in the equator, they tend to eat spicy food.
Very interesting. All right. Diet. Kiana, I'm curious, are there certain foods your kids will or won't eat when it's hot? Even just the thought of turning on the oven sometimes is like, oh, my God, please, no.
Oh, yeah. For me, we tend to grill out a lot, eating outside. So we don't do a lot of indoor cooking. We do a lot of salads and things like that. But from a heat perspective, what the caller was saying, I feel him on that. We're still eating our spicy foods over here all through the summer. So we just recently acquired, through a good friend, some new ranges of hot sauce. So we've been enjoying a little bit of a taste test session here and there.
All right. I'll be over at about 4:30. Sounds good. let's go to Beverly in Watertown. Beverly, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm calling because heat is a killer. very important for people to know during these heat waves that some of the people who are most vulnerable are old, isolated, poor people of color.
Yeah, it's a good reminder.
And that means you're not just looking out to say how are you doing with your neighbors. You're looking out to make sure that they are well.
Yeah, that's a great point, Beverly. And I want to use that to ask Sanjay. You talked about checking on your neighbors. We mentioned specifically elderly neighbors. What exactly should that look like? What should the conversations be? And what can you offer those folks in terms of assistance, do you think?
Yeah, Beverly, that's a great question. You know, elderly residents can reach out to 311 and connect to our Age Strong Commission. They're a commission in the city that specifically focuses on helping elderly residents access resources. But, you know, what does it mean to try to help someone check in on your neighbors? Ask them how they're doing. Have them reflect on their health. Ask them how many glasses of water they've had. You know, like you're going to go talk to your grandmother. There are simple things to check in on. You know, are they taking their medication? Do they need support? Maybe you can invite them over to sit in your AC. There's a lot of things you can do, and it's good to be creative and really bring your empathy to it. No one wants to go to bed hot. And if anyone who's listening has gone to bed in 80, 90 degree weather, it's no fun. So, you know, be creative, be supportive, and think about how you would like to be treated if you were yourself lacking access to cooling.
Kiana, I'm thinking also about the other end of the spectrum with kids who maybe don't know their own bodies quite as well as adults and don't recognize when they are becoming overheated. Is that something you talk about with your kids, or is it just something you keep an eye on? And how do you address that?
Yes, definitely. And for us, you know, being Black as well, and not mistakenly thinking that we're protected from the sun just because of our melanin, that's something I ingrain in my kids too. So, you know, even when my son is begging to stay outside, like that super duper slip and slide I mentioned, he wanted to hang out for hours. And I had to explain, you know, we got to head in, you know, we need a break. We've been out in the sun. So just communicating that, I mean, we stay sun safe too, especially I have discoid lupus. And so being sun safe is really important to me, making sure that I wear sunscreen every day. So my entire family has fallen into that habit set by me of making sure before we head out that we're covered in sunscreen and, you know, our sun safe hats and whatever else we need.
All right. And that's Kiana Ogbai, Boston parent, entrepreneur, author of the blog and Instagram account, Harlem Lovebirds. Kiana, thanks so much, as always, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Sanjay Sate, Climate Resilience Program Manager for the City of Boston. Sanjay, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beelin. We had help today from Ali Audet, Stephen Gelman, and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer is Glenn Alexander. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.